Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I'm David Goldstein. It's July 26th, 2021. You're listening to The Drop.
Happy Monday, everyone out there. Hope you're all doing well. Hope you had a great weekend. Hope you are getting excited here for so much to come. We're going to get into it, but baseball trade deadline, fish tour, so much more. I am getting ready to go on a road trip to California with my family. I'm pretty excited about that. But David, how are you doing right now?
I think I'm doing pretty well. My road trip is going to be to Cape Cod. That's actually my family. That's not going to happen until the Saturday of next week. I think the week after this one. But there's some interesting news came down in the baseball world. Breaking news just before we decided to record this, actually. What might that be?
So the Cleveland baseball team, formerly known as, I guess we can say it.
Yeah.
Can we say the old name?
Yeah, we can say the old name. We can say it.
The Indians. They just changed their name again. So they went from Indians to the Cleveland baseball team. Or were they the Indians this year?
I think they were the Indians this year. I think.
They were still the Indians. But we knew that they were changing their name. They changed their name to swap out the first two syllables. And you get Guardians. The Cleveland Guardians. The most focused group name possible?
I don't know if it's the most focused group name possible because it seems like the least amount of effort possible. It has the same amount of
that's true.
The same amount of syllables, the same vowel sounds. Like, I don't mean, are they trying to guard home plate? Are they trying to guard the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame from posers? I mean, like, I don't know.
They're not trying to guard a 3-1 lead in the World Series is what they're not trying to guard.
No, they're certainly not trying to guard that. It's big baseball stars energy. If you're in your late 30s or early 40s, you probably played the classic NES game with the Ninja Black Sox and the Pink Ladies, and I could have definitely seen the Cleveland Guardians taking on the Ninja Black Sox and Baseball Stars.
Yeah, it sounds like a fake baseball team name in like a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like a made-for-TV movie that would play on like the Lifetime Channel or something.
Yeah, and to be clear, I think this is a much more preferable name to Indians. That probably should have been retired. Probably never should have been the team name, but probably should have been retired decades ago, if not sooner. But this, I feel once again, so my baseball team, as listeners out there know, is the Chicago Cubs. We played an epic series against the Cleveland baseball team, now Guardians, back in 2016. We came out on top. I will be very clear. I empathize heavily with some of my good friends who are Cleveland baseball fans. I do want to see that team succeed. I think it's tough when they build up a great team like they had in the middle part of the 2010s and then have to sell off their guys because there's just no way that they're going to afford players like Francisco Lindor, Corey Kluber. That said, I feel for them all once again and want to give a personal shout out to one of our favorite listeners and favorite people, Ben Gardner, who I know is a diehard Cleveland baseball fan. I am sorry that you have to root for the Guardians now. This would, to me, be like if the Chicago Cubs changed their name to, I don't know, the Chicago Moose or something like that. It's just like, just similar enough, but you're just sitting there being like, why am I calling my team this? I don't know. I think this is kind of a joke, and I could see a rebrand coming sometime around like 2035, a little bit too late.
Also, shout out to our friend and listener, Marcus Gilmer. I think he's a Cubs fan, but he lives in Cleveland, and he likes baseball, so I'm sure he's got an opinion on it. Andrew Steckler, another good buddy, big Cleveland baseball fan. Ultimately, better than the Indians. I mean, that absolutely had to go for any number of reasons. But the Guardians, I don't know, kind of like what was the Al Pacino movie, Any Given Sunday, when instead of the Super Bowl, they played for, what was it, like the Pantheon Cup, or I don't know. But
couldn't get the license.
Couldn't get the license. All right, enough with the baseball chatter. So we're recording this on July 23rd, but you're listening to it probably around July 26th. Just wanted to shout out July 26th, 2017. Of course, that was the powdered night at the Baker's Dozen. Hoo boy, that was a good fish show. Obviously, tour is coming up, so I'll probably do a quick Baker's Dozen like revisit, as you know, kind of like 4 years ago is when these shows were occurring right now. Powder Night might have been my favorite night of that run, just because any number of reasons. The 1999 missed it completely. Powderfinger Encore, huge two, Pebbles and Marbles, just a phenomenal show.
Yeah, you and I are on the same page with this. I mean, I fully respect what they did with Jam Night. I think that that was one of the most inventive set lists that the band has ever toyed with, the most inventive song, like, structural approaches that we've ever heard from them, and just amazing to hear songs like Sample in a Jar, Lawn Boy, My Friend, get jammed out the way that they were. And songs like Fuego and Cross-Eyed and Painless, those jams still hold up. But my favorite night of the Baker's Dozen is Powder Night. The first set on paper, I remember seeing it on paper. I was at a work function that night. Not the greatest set list on paper, but when you hear it, everything just pops. There's a little bit of an extra to each song. Farmhouse is beautiful. The very long Fuse has a really excellent jam off of it. The Tube, obviously, the Madchester Tube, as Dave coined it almost immediately.
Right.
And then set two is just a suite of songs that no Fish fan would ever in their right mind pair together. I don't know anybody that was calling for the return of 1999. I think that we all figured that was a one-off, and somehow they brought it back.
I'm not even positive that the band knew that they were going to play 1999 that night.
They just kind of went into it and went for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that set also has like Steam is really elongated and like feels really like slow and plodding and grooving and kind of builds to this swell of noise. I seem to remember the character Zero even has a really cool jam in it.
Yeah, Zero had a cool Trey and Mike duel.
And then obviously you have the encore of Powderfinger, which every time I hear that. I've said this before. It is my eternal song request. I don't care what band I'm seeing. I hope that you play Powderfinger, and hearing Fish play it, I hope that that was not a one-timer.
And they opened with their a cappella version of Fleet Foxes' Wet Winter Hymnal.
That was a huge moment.
Yes, Virginia, there are jam bands before Goose that covered Fleet Foxes.
Yeah, that was a great show, and it's fun whenever we get to this time of year now, and we kind of remember, like, my biggest takeaway from the Baker's Dozen was, like, from afar, not only was the music great, but just how all-inclusive and just, like, for 3 weeks, the entire Fish community was focused on what is the donut release today, okay, cool, what songs are they going to play tonight, and then they play the show, and it's almost better than you could ever imagine. I mean, I would count 12 of the 13 shows as full show re-listens, with even the 13th that I would keep out of that being Boston Cream still having an incredible first set and one of my favorite ghosts of 3.0.
Yeah, the ghost of that show is extremely good. Rest of the set, that second set has some issues. Obviously, the Boston Cream joke in the first set was pretty great. We'll certainly have a little more discussion of upcoming Fish tours we get a bit later in the episode. Want to transition to something that if we were radio shock jocks, we would have to have a big, like, fire engine siren for this news. Holy shit! October, there's going to be a new War on Drugs record. This matters.
This matters, man. When we started our first podcast back in the spring of 2017, Beyond the Pond, it was about 3 weeks into that show that the War on Drugs dropped their first single off of A Deeper Understanding, which is, of course, Thinking of a Place, an 11-minute epic exploration of basically everything that makes the War on Drugs the War on Drugs. And here we are recording our third episode for the drop, and the War on Drugs returns with another album. Is this their fifth album, I believe? Yeah, this is the fifth War on Drugs album.
Yeah, this is definitely WOD number 5.
I Don't Live Here Anymore, which is a very apt War on Drugs title. And the initial single that came out for this, Living Proof, is a very War on Drugs song. What are your thoughts on this, and what are you thinking about as we get to the album release cycle?
I think Living Proof is a great song. It's certainly more mellow than you would expect from a War on Drugs first single and or the first song on a War on Drugs record. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's not the big roundhouse punch, something like a Red Eyes or like Under the Pressure. I'm sure the record will have those types of bangers, but this is, you know, it's a very good contemplative way to start a record that almost kind of sounds like, reminds me of a shorter version. What's the last song called on Wilco's The Whole Love?
One Sunday Morning.
Yeah, One Sunday Morning. It kind of has that sort of contemplative, quiet, acoustic, strummy feel that builds up to sort of like a non-guitar solo guitar solo and then fades out.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not the type of top-down, driving down the highway song that the War on Drugs can drop and provide the drop of a hat, I should say. But I think the record, from what I'm hearing, is going to have plenty of those bangers. So I'm kind of happy to have this, like, contemplative start.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with you. I was thinking about this a lot. Obviously, we're 4 years in between the last album cycle, Deeper Understanding, which came out in August of 2017. The band had been on about a 3-year cycle, and I have to imagine if COVID hadn't hit, we would have gotten something either late 2020 or early 2021. This sounded like, from a couple of the IG live streams Adam did last year, that this was somewhat ready to roll. That said, you know, if there was a time for the War on Drugs to shift gears and present a different approach to albums and their songwriting and kind of experiment a little bit, this is probably the record to do it. And listening to this song, it sounds like they're not going to go down that path, which I am personally completely okay with. I love the War on Drugs sound. If I had it my way, Adam could continue writing Americana, Heartland, rock songs and ballads for the rest of time. And if we got 20 albums of those, it would make me a very happy person. So like, I feel like this is the time in their career where if they were going to take a left turn and try something completely different, this is when they would. To me, Living Proof is it's kind of a message to the listeners that we're making a War on Drugs record. It's going to be just an updated take on where Adam is as a songwriter, now as a dad, utilizing the same tools that he used on A Deeper Understanding. And I think that the biggest takeaway I have from this, beyond the fact that like this sounds like it's a further embrace of the War on Drugs sound, is what you're talking about with that anti-guitar solo. This is a very minimalistic song. The lyrics are kind of almost spoken word to you, just like flashes in his mind of kind of what is happening at that point in time. He's not trying to go for like a massive message. He's not trying to go for a massive symbolism. He's just trying to go for a quality song that utilizes the tricks that you anticipate with the War on Drugs. And it's a cool sort of muted message when you compare it to the last two initial singles being Thinking of a Place. And was the first single off of Lost in the Dream, An Ocean Between the Waves, or was it Red Eyes?
It was Red Eyes.
Okay. Either way, Red Eyes is like, it has everything that you would want from a War on Drugs song. And like, it's just big. And to take that step up from where they were at with Slave Ambient to hear that song, you knew that Lost in the Dream is going to be this big record. Thinking of a Place gave you this indication that, oh my God, Adam finally got the studio. He finally got the money needed to record in the studio that can fully capture all of his sounds. Now, with Living Proof, it's a little bit more muted. It's a little bit more reserved, but still has all the tricks.
Also, in between records, he became a dad. He has a son with Kristen Ritter, you know, actress who's in Breaking Bad season 2, who's in Jessica, she's Jessica Jones. So just looking at this War on Drugs track listing, I can already see the potential for glorious sappy songs about my beautiful child. I mean, song 9, Rings Around My Father's Eyes, that's like the most War on Drugsy song title ever. That's going to have some lesson about him being a dad and the hardship of his dad and how he feels differently looking through his son's eyes and his father's eyes. The song writes itself. Maybe that's not what it's about at all. I don't know. Track 4, I Don't Want to Wait. Probably not a Paula Cole song, although I think the War on Drugs would do a really great cover of that Dawson's Creek anthem. I don't know. I think if that was actually a Paula Cole cover, we'd probably know about it by now. But no, very much looking forward to it. You know, there's some certain bands that kind of the old baseball illusion is do whatever got you up here, which is to say if there's something that you're good at, don't shy away from it, embrace it. Because, you know, if you're a good enough baseball player to play in the majors, you got your specialties. And, you know, I think the War on Drugs, big sweeping heartland rock is a specialty that really nobody else does it as well. So if that's what we get more of here, I'm perfectly happy and perfectly excited to hear the rest. And from what we've been told, it's going to be great. So
yeah, I'm excited for it. I can't wait to hear this record. And I just bought tickets to see them out here at the Mission Ballroom in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, me too. Not in Colorado. I got tickets to see them at the Garden. MSG. They're going for it.
It's amazing, isn't it? I can't wait to hear that sound in the Garden. I'm considering, I'm going to see what tickets are like, but I'm considering flying to New York for that. That feels like just a moment of...
I got 2 tickets. The other one hasn't been claimed yet. They're in section 119, so we'll have access to spicy chicken sandwich when we're, you know, swaying to the breeze. There we go.
Love it. The other thing I wanted to note from an album release cycle standpoint is... Bob Dylan just announced this week a new box set. I believe it's his 16th bootleg series, focusing on 1980 to 1985. I celebrate this on a number of levels, and I will explain why. Last year around this time, I did a full Bob Dylan re-listen. I listened to every single Bob Dylan studio album, every single bootleg series, the entire discography. I think it was around 67 records, all in full. And it took me about 2 or 3 months as I was listening to a few other things. And the period I was most unfamiliar with was the early 80s, which I think is pretty common for a lot of people who even love Bob Dylan. I walked away with a completely new appreciation for the craftsmanship that he had in that period. He spent a lot of time in New York City. He recorded a number of his latter evangelical records, Saved, which, and Shot of Love, which I loved way more on re-listen than I had loved the first time I listened to. Infidels is one of the best Bob Dylan albums ever. And then Empire Burlesque is one of the most controversial Bob Dylan albums ever. If you're a Dylan fan and you haven't heard Empire Burlesque, highly, highly, highly recommend just spinning it once. I will not say it's good, but it is interesting in its failures. The fascinating part about all these records is, like so many of Dylan's incredible periods, are the bootlegs. And especially, there's a song on Empire Burlesque called When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky that sounds terrible on the record. And it's long and it's digital, but it's digital in that like early to mid 1980s weird digital phase. But there's a version of it on the original bootleg series, bootlegs 1 through 3, where he covered 1961 and 1991. It's the second to last song on the entire series that sounds like a War on Drugs song. Like it is truly an American Heartland song. And around that era, he was recording a lot of songs like that. And so a lot of these songs from this period have a full band approach, a live band approach, this like big sound with like properly placed synthesizers rather than this kind of muted digital sound where Bob Dylan just sounds like he's singing into the void while some like computers are playing around him. So I am incredibly excited for this. I would encourage any of our listeners who like Bob Dylan but have not explored the early 80s, get familiar with it because this is going to be a fantastic box set series. My only issue, Knocked Out Loaded came out in 1986. It is a deeply, deeply underrated Bob Dylan album. Has one of his best songs, Brownsville Girl, on it. I sincerely hope that there are some aspects from that session on here, but I just wish that this went 1 year further. I just wish that we had that. Maybe we'll have a bootleg series on that session, though, at some point.
My 80s Dylan blind spot could take up the gigantic red spot on Jupiter. So that's your thing. It's not really my thing. That's my fault. I should try harder to listen to 80s Dylan. I listened to the Infidels record a few times. That's pretty good. But yeah, I'll let you do most of the talk in regard to 80s Dylan.
So transitioning here, let's talk a bit about what we've been listening to from Osiris Media. What's kind of been percolating your ears from a podcasting standpoint these last couple of days?
Certainly, one that we haven't talked about yet, but we absolutely love, is 36 from the Vault, being the podcast where our compadres, Stephen Hayden and Rob Mitchum, great guys, great music journalists, they go through the Grateful Dead Dick's Pick series one by one and go into these very deep discussions where they set the stage, the time period, pop culture tidbits from the period, and go through the shows song by song. So the most recent one, which came out, is Dick's Picks number 26, which is portions of two shows from April of 1969 in the Midwest. One show is from Chicago, one show is from Minneapolis. Their episodes are always interesting. I found this one particularly interesting because at one of the shows, the Grateful Dead shared the bill with the Velvet Underground. And in 1969, in terms of a live sound, those two bands had a lot more in common than you might think. And certainly, Stephen and Rob, they know the Dead, and they also know the Velvets. So kind of like their comparisons and their deep dive into the two bands and what that might have been like and what one could have expected and just the juxtapositions of the two is, you know, it's very well done. It's very informative, and those guys have just built up a rapport that's like sitting in a basement with beers with your buddies talking music. So I would really recommend that podcast highly, and especially that one episode. It's you know, it's an in-depth podcast. It's long. Most of them are over 2 hours, but I find it's a quick 2 hours just because I get into it, and it's kind of become one of the podcasts I look forward to hearing on my walking commute when I take my kid to daycare. It's 15 minutes each way, so I can take out a chunk, a half hour, and I, you know, like finish over the course of a week.
Yeah, it was it's a really good episode. Full disclosure, I do all the production and editing work on 36 from the Vault. It's a major labor of love. I'm currently, as at time of recording, finishing up the final episode of season 3, which is Dick's Picks 27. That will be out as this episode goes live. But yeah, the Dick's Picks 26 episode was really interesting. It's been an interesting season for 36 from the Vault. We've had some banger type of episodes, like Dick's Picks 19 was the season premiere focusing on Fall 73. Nobody can argue with Fall 73. Dick's Picks 22 jumped back to 1968 and had just this really wild Primal Dead rocking set with just incredible jamming, crazy weird set listing. Dick's Picks 25 was a double disc, quadruple disc, double show celebrating the silver anniversary of the Dick's Picks series with two shows from 1978, Spring 78. My personal favorite episode of the season was Dick's Picks 21. It's a top three Dick's Picks for me. It's from the fall of 1985. It is very mid-80s Dead. You get
the Rochester?
It's Richmond.
Richmond. Yeah, November. Okay.
You get just like this really cool second set that has a wild He's Gone into Spoonful. You've got a great Give Me Some Lovin' and She Belongs to Me. Saint of Circumstance and Lost Sailor. Actually, I should say Lost Sailor and Saint of Circumstance are split apart by Drum Space. It's just a really cool exploration of the Dead in 1985 and during a kind of untapped period, lots of Brent. But Dick's Picks 26 was good. It was another jump back to the 60s. It was not my favorite volume that we've covered in the larger series. It's not my particular favorite era. It's kind of that acoustic electric balancing act that the band was going through as they're recording or getting ready to record American Beauty and Working Man's Dead. But the second disc, which basically was a reinterpretation of the Live Dead set, was cool. And also you hear in this episode, Rob and Steve argue in a more bitter fashion than I've heard in any single Dick's Picks volume, which was great. And we're kind of matching that here on the opposite side of it from a host standpoint in Dick's Picks 27, which is fun. But yeah, it was good. I as someone who puts a lot of hours and love into that show, I highly recommend it.
What else do we have in terms of Osiris podcast you've been digging as of late, Brian?
So another Dead-related podcast, if you will, I want to highly recommend Comes a Time's recent episode with Amir Bar-Lev, the film director who did a lot of Grateful Dead-related work. This was a fascinating conversation between Mike Fenoya and Oteil Burbridge, the hosts of Comes a Time, and Amir. I took a lot away from, but overall, just stepping back kind of like 10,000-foot view of the show, you're getting really good conversations with really notable people that tend to have a focus in some way, shape, or form around the world of the Grateful Dead. So pairing that with 36 from the Vault, you get some really great Dead content. I would also add Broke Down podcast from Osiris Media to really round out the overall Dead approach that we have here at Osiris Media. But this was just a fascinating conversation that we're going to get into it here in a second because there were some aspects of it that really we took a lot away from. But the larger conversation around how your perspective has shifted through the pandemic was probably the most powerful aspect of this overall episode. What did you think about it though?
Yeah, certainly that aspect of it. There's also lots of discussion about the Beats. They had some discussion about like psychedelics and, you know, a lot of discussion about kind of being in the moment. Of course, most of our listeners probably know Amir Bar-Lev as the individual who directed the I think, 5-part dead documentary on Amazon Prime, Long Strange Trip. So, you know, he was certainly very much into it. And the co-host, Mike Fenoya, he's a comedian, very nice guy. And Utile Burbridge, the bass player, he's with Dead & Co., was with Almonds, was the Aquarium Rescue Unit. He's got his own band. He's everywhere.
In Vita Blue.
Yeah, right, Vita Blue. Everywhere in the jam world. And, you know, with those guys, they're very affable. And what I like about that show is that it doesn't feel like a celebrity interview so much as it feels just like three guys talking shop every time. It's very, they're very good at getting people to get their guard down. You know, it's just like a very, very pleasant conversation. So, kind of shifting into a larger discussion, one of the things that they did talk about in that episode of Comes a Time was kind of how the pandemic changed their perspectives on music. And at least for me, I mean, the one thing I keep coming back to, all everything involving the pandemic, even now, having to deal with aspects of the Delta variant in the pandemic, is don't take anything for granted. Don't assume that the band you want to see is going to come back or is going to be able to play. If I have tickets to something or if I'm on the fence about a show and I can get to that show without sacrificing family health or having to get a babysitter, I'm going to go because I don't take concerts for granted anymore. I don't even take simple things like just going out to eat, have like a pleasant dinner with my wife in like a crowded restaurant for granted. You know, it just really puts things into perspective, as in if you have an opportunity to do something that's going to be culturally enlightening, maybe you should do it instead of staying home. Also being present in the moment, which they talk a lot about, how like Jerry Garcia happened to be present in the moment.
I second that viewpoint and that perspective shift. And I feel like in some case, like you and I had it, but I know, like, you know, just kind of internal conversations, there were a lot of times where we both would discuss like, I've got tickets for this upcoming show, but I've got this happening. You know, do I go to the show? And I think that perspective has changed a bit in terms of you can't take it for granted when you have an opportunity. I think back to, I mentioned this in our last episode, I had an opportunity to see Oysterhead 10 minutes from my house and kind of let life get in the way. You know, in some cases I feel like I did the right thing, but also like, man, I missed, you know, what was an excellent concert. And then that was something that I just simply couldn't get for the next year and a half, which was really tough to wrestle with. I think as well, though, you know, one of the biggest lessons I got from the pandemic, it's sometimes hard as listeners to separate the experiences that you see and hear in both recorded music and live music from the personal lives that musicians live and the challenges that they live with. And I think back to, I have a really close friend, John McGar, who regularly listens back to an episode that we recorded with Tim Showalter back in the spring of 2019 on Beyond the Pond. And there's a section around like 18 to 23 minutes where Tim talks a lot about being present and a lot about empathy and a lot about, like, you know, overcoming your own personal demons and your own personal struggles. And that period for me, this is pre-pandemic, was really an awakening period of like the personal lives that musicians live. And I feel like around that time, I started understanding more clearly the importance for a lot of musicians on clear-mindedness, on being present, for some musicians on sobriety, and, you know, really kind of restructuring their lives and their own priorities so that they could approach their work in a clear-minded, creative way. but also the sense that every single artist is essentially walking this tightrope between survival, success, complete failure, and that risk that they're taking and the demons that they're battling against was fully exposed during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
And for a lot of artists was exposed in a way that, you know, horrible things happened as a result of it. And so I think that I certainly agree with you on the cultural standpoint. I also think that it has been a real perspective shift in terms of, we have a small platform here. We, you know, have the ability to speak to a certain amount of people about music that we care about. We are both connoisseurs of music. Understanding the people behind the music is something that really kind of came to me. And I think, you know, from small musicians who simply could not continue to work and were experimenting with everything from like an Instagram live stream to not playing at all because of health concerns or because of financial issues, all the way up to larger musicians like Trey Anastasio of Phish, who put all of this effort into the Beacon Jams and, you know, found the one way that he could connect with fans during this. You saw the need for a lot of musicians to simply just play music. And right. You saw and heard the need of them to push forward this art that they create that really, like, at the end of the day, beyond, you know, you're short of money to live and eat, is like the lifeblood for them to survive. So kind of being able to understand that and think about that has helped me from a perspective standpoint. It's helped me to take certain risks in my own life, knowing that, like, we get one shot to do this whole thing, and you might as well, you know, go after certain dreams. But also, you know, the empathy that I think we as listeners need to have on a regular basis for the overall challenge and risk that artists are taking on a day-to-day basis, not just from a health standpoint, but from a personal livelihood standpoint, to bring us as much music as they have.
I would agree entirely with that. That gets very well put. It certainly has increased my empathy towards artists, and it's been fascinating and a bit trying to see the creative methods in which they use to get the music out there, whether it being, like you said, live streams, Instagram Live, things like Patreon pages, just to like be able to raise some money, because, you know, a lot of these bands that we see, their entire lifeblood, it's touring dried up.
Yeah.
It was everything. And then kind of
yeah.
Shifting while we're on the subject of tour, obviously when this comes out, as of right now, Phish is scheduled to open their summer tour this Wednesday, July 28th, in this great state of Arkansas, which has kind of been in the news lately for all the wrong reasons, and that it's the vaccination levels are low enough that the Delta variant seems to have taken a bit of a hold in that state, which is, you know, not great. Certainly, it's some people, fans we know going to Arkansas, they've had to kind of take like some risk factors in mind, even if they're vaccinated. Should they still mask up when they're going to shows? I mean, my feeling is if you have the vaccine and you're outdoors and you're masked up, then, you know, I mean, chances are you'll probably be okay, certainly in a much better circumstance than if you are unvaccinated. And I would just use the small platform to say, if you happen to be listening to this podcast right now and you're unvaccinated, my God, what are you waiting for? Please get the vaccine. It's safe. It's effective. And if you want your favorite musicians to be able to play shows in September and October when they have ended up booking all these indoor shows, then where you going to have to get vaccinated, because there's no other way.
I'm on the exact same page with you. I mean, I would say, you know, if there's any lesson of the pandemic, it's no matter how isolated we can all be in our own communities and our own bubbles on a digital standpoint, at the end of the day, we are still connected on a physical level and we still impact others on a day-to-day basis. And I think you learned this immediately in the pandemic. I feel like I learned this immediately in the pandemic. The sacrifices that we were going to have to make to reduce, to flatten the curve, if you will, to reduce larger deaths, larger hospital surges, was going to take a lot from all of us. And it was going to be painful for people on a variety of different ways. As someone who did not see the worst of things in the pandemic in any sort of way, it was still a really challenging year. And I think that anyone in our position could say the same sort of thing. You know, seeing family, seeing friends, all that was gone. And I understood that. And I felt that that was important. And I look at the vaccine the same sort of way. Doing this is something to help out larger society. It is to help you out, but it's also to help other people out. Every single decision that we make impacts a multitude of people, seen and unseen. The only other thing I would say is we are only at this place in modern society because of scientific breakthroughs and because of the impact of scientists who have figured out ways to understand genetic modeling, vaccine distribution, medical science on levels that 50, 100, 200, 300,000 years ago would have never seemed possible.
No.
To not get the vaccine is not to be smarter than the scientists. It is to embrace ignorance that has muddied the world for its entire existence. And I would just ask you to make a sacrifice for your fellow man rather than for your own individual senses of being smarter than others.
Yeah. As the father of a daughter who at 2 months old had open heart surgery, I am particularly offended by those who believe that they are smarter than the legions of scientists, doctors, and incredible epidemiologists that happen to be out there. So go to fish. Maybe if you're in a crowd, mask up. Enjoy the shows. God, I'm going to fucking enjoy the show sitting on my couch. I can't wait.
So on that, why don't we get to recommending some music for our listeners before we wrap up for this week. We're going to go through a new album recommendation as we do every week. And we're also going to continue this fun little journey down 5 year leaps back in time. And we'll give you guys a classic album from summer 2011. Dave, what is the new album that you want to recommend this week?
This is a record that came out on June 25th. This is a band that if you've been listening to Beyond the Pond or just talking to me or seeing the clothes I wear, you know I like. It's the third album from Rose City Band, of course being the project of Ripley Johnson up in Portland, Oregon. Album is called Earth Trip, and it's a little bit of a left turn for these guys. The first two Rose City Band albums were some, you know, wonderful slices of kind of chugling country rock that owed a lot to the Grateful Dead, owed a lot to the Allman Brothers. You know, sort of things that sounded really good at barbecues, really good in the car. And the second record kind of like beefed up the production values from the first record, but they're both kind of cut from the same cloth. So album number three, it's a different vibe. This is much more, I don't want to use the phrase post-apocalyptic, but it's much more subdued. The songs go on longer. It's got some more, it sounds like a record that would have been recorded during a global pandemic, and that there's definitely like a lot more on dudes' minds seemingly than there was in the past. No, this is particularly evident on the last song, Dawn Patrol, which I just kept hearing in my head all last week is in New York, the from the wildfires out west in Oregon, the smoke got to the point where it was actually clouding the skies in New York City, and the sun took on a very strange red hue. And I just kept hearing Dawn Patrol in my head. It's kind of like more of like a dark, shoegazy version of like the Rose City Band. Yeah, this album doesn't sound as good in the car as the other two, but the deeper I've gotten into it, I've realized that it's still as good as the first two albums in terms of establishing a vibe, in terms of having incredible musicians play on it. It's as much as it's a showcase for guitar playing of the frontman Ripley Johnson, even more so it's a showcase for the pedal steelwork of Barry Walker Jr., which is just gorgeous. I mean, there's the most pedal steel on this record relative to the other Rose City Band albums, and it just winds its way through these songs like a river. Really quite something to behold. But this is an album to listen to on the couch, something to listen to on your porch as the sun is coming up and you may be in a certain state, unclear. But yeah, if you give it some more time, it will absolutely grow on you like a weed. It certainly did for me. So Rose City Band, Earth Trip, check it out.
Wide open spaces make me feel at home when I've been so forlorn. Hear lonely traces on the telephone when I've been gone.
Yeah, I will second that pick. I absolutely love Earth Trip, and I want to give a personal shout out to one of my close friends, Zach Birdwell, who I worked with in Portland, Oregon, is a fantastic guitarist, and was brought on to be the touring lead guitarist for Rose City Band as they embark on their first tour and first set of live shows in the next couple of months. Friend of the pod, Ryan Jewell, also plays on this record, which he does some fantastic percussion work. I'm hoping to catch Rose City Band. There's a tentative hint that they're going to come through, kind of do a West Coast tour, come through Denver at some point. So I'm hoping to see my buddy Zach raging up there with Ripley. It would be awesome. The record that I am going to discuss is one I've listened to now 4 or 5 times since I decided to feature it here yesterday. Conan Moccasin and A Day, It's Just Wind. This is like Brian Brinkman BTP hardcore. This is my wheelhouse on so many levels. So Conan Moccasin is a nom de rock of a New Zealand psych rocker who's recorded this record with his father, A Day Hosford. This came together after A Day had a brush with death in 2018, and the two convened to write a record in the late 2010s. The album title and much of the album is filled with horrible dad jokes. The name of the album, It's Just Wind, is a tribute to A Day's evergreen defense of flatulence. And throughout, Moccasin's father, A Day, narrates much of this record in a sort of sing-speak type of manner that's reminiscent of Bill Callahan. It's reminiscent of Scott Walker. It's reminiscent, in some cases, of Leonard Cohen. And the record like kind of winds through these kind of plotting stories. Some of them have a point that's only distant towards the end. Some of them are filled with crude jokes. Some of them are filled with straight up bad jokes. It feels very much like a father and son communicating through music. On a musical level, it is one of my most diverse records that I've heard this year, and it bounces back and forth between psychedelic Americana road trips, as well as kind of technically driven, almost Nicholas Jarre style electronic music. So it's really hard to put your fist down and say, this is what this record is. It kind of jumps all around the place. It's a really fantastic listen that kind of keeps you guessing, keeps you asking for more. It's definitely going to appear in my top albums list just based on how many times I've been listening to it here over the last couple of days. But I highly, highly recommend all of our listeners jump in. It's definitely one of the weirder records I've listened to this year, but I really like it. It's Conan Moccasin and A Day, It's Just Wind.
And the afternoon sun, dead brown grasses laid low, like a shaggy tobacco. In contrast with your sloppy gray winds, beyond with the white birds diving, we
yawn with the white birds diving. Glide along with broom or brain. Easy woods towards the main lagoon. Choke with land and winter wind. Home to the old couple.
So next, to close out, what we're going to do is talk about, we think of our classic summer albums from 2011. So last time on the podcast, we did 2016, so we're backing up 5 years, and I think we'll probably continue to do that for at least another few episodes, because it's kind of been fun to go back and see where our heads were in these five-year chunks. So a record that I listened to a ton in 2011 was Kurt Vile, Smoke Ring from My Halo. Still my favorite Kurt Vile record. I think it's the one that has the songwriting comes into the clearest focus. It doesn't quite have the rangy jams of, say, his record Waking on a Pretty Days, but it still has my favorite collection of songs. I really like the John Agnello production, and it definitely is the one that kind of feels the most like staring out the window of your tour bus. I mean, he has a song on the record called On Tour, which seems to be about exactly doing that. But it has kind of a lazy, hazy hue that make it ideal for summer barbecues and or back porch navel gazing. And, you know, I don't think Kurt Vile has any bad records, but that one is kind of the one where I think he came into his own and I first discovered him. And that's still probably, like I said, my favorite Kurt record. I think maybe in second would be Waking on a Pretty Days, followed by Bottle It In. And I like Believe I'm Going Down, maybe not as much as those other three. You know, he has some earlier records like Childish Prodigy's pretty good. But I think if you're listening to this podcast, there's a 75% chance you're familiar with this album. But listen to it anyway. It's really good.
On tour, Lord of the Flies, all they cares. What's a guitar? Watch out for this one. They'll stab you in the back for fun. I'm just playing.
Yeah, that Kurt Vile record is fantastic, and I will just note that that record was something of a grower for me. I first heard of Kurt Vile through Childish Prodigy, and I loved the grungy, dirgy sound of it. Loved the like War on Drugs songscapiness of Freak Train, and then I absolutely loved it. My favorite record of his is Waking on a Pretty Day. I've since come around, and Smoke Ring from My Halo is an absolute classic. You're absolutely right. It has that hazy, woozy feeling of waking up on a tour bus, driving across Nebraska or something like that, and trying to understand exactly where you're at. Bottle It In was one of my favorite records from 2018, and Believe I'm Going Down, I did not like at all when it initially came out. I went and saw Kurt Vile in 2019, and he played a number of songs from it, and it really kind of popped for me then. So I've since grown on Believe I'm Going Down. It's definitely a good record. I think that and Smoke Ring kind of grew on me over the years. I am going to talk about my favorite record from 2011, and I believe, I didn't check this before we went to recording, but I believe this was my number 10 favorite record of the decade, which is Bon Iver's self-titled record. This record came out in early summer 2011. I was living in one of my favorite apartments I've ever lived in my entire life. We had this really beautiful tree out of our south window. We had north-south facing windows, so we got really interesting sunlight in there. It was like this classic Portland-style apartment, probably built mid-century, really nice hardwood floors, very small. Very, very tiny. Somehow my wife and I and our dog survived in there. But this record came out, and you know, through June, you get still a lot of rain in the Pacific Northwest. It feels like an elongated spring, whereas the rest of the country is starting to experience summer for the first time that year. And I remember sitting up, windows open, listening to the rainfall, listening to this record, and really feeling from a sonic standpoint like it was a part of where I was at that point in my life. I was cooking. I wasn't making a lot of money. I was riding my bike every day. I was trying to scrap together time to, you know, continue writing about music and listening to as much music as possible. And every time I threw this record on, it kind of threw me down this rabbit hole of Midwestern adventurism, kind of mid-20s, directionless, where do I go in my life at this point in time? And every time I put it on it since then, it takes me back to that period, but it also continues to hold up. Sonically, it's one of my favorite records I've ever heard. It kind of opened a portal for me into kind of late 70s, early 80s, kind of soft rock, you know, synthesizer tones, gated drums, the falsetto that Justin Vernon sings in throughout the record, but also the larger experimentation that is filled within every single one of those songs had just lessons upon lessons about how to listen to music for me. So I absolutely love this record. I would encourage anyone, similar to Kurt Vile, if you listen to Dave and I talk about music, you've probably heard this record at some point in your life, but I would encourage you to listen to it again. It's a great evening summertime album.
So, thank you very much for listening. There's going to be exciting times coming up. I'm sure we'll have some discussion of Fish Tour and some future episodes, obviously. We'll talk about the greater Osiris universe. We'll talk about upcoming releases and classic releases.
Yeah, we'll be back. We'll probably talk a bit about summer tour. We'll talk about new music that's happening. I think that as the music world continues to wrestle with what is happening right now and how to survive and how to keep going and where the unknowns are taking us with this whole COVID cycle that we continue to remain in, we'll continue to talk about it and see what happens. And also, I've got to imagine by the next time we record, my baseball team will look a lot different, and your team might actually benefit from my team looking differently. So that'll be a fun conversation if it happens.
There's definitely going to be some moves made at the trade deadline by the next recording. That is true. July 30th, things are going to go down. I believe our listeners are going to be incredibly excited to hear about that. So come back next Monday. We will talk some baseball, talk some Fish, talk some new releases. Hold hands, mask up, get our shots, and listen to The Drop.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11. Oh.